Hello, you're listening to FlixWise Canada. I'm Martin Kessler, and I'm journeying into the night. But luckily, I have somebody to take my keys off my hands for a little while. There's joining me is actor and writer Galen Howard. Hi, Galen. How are you?
Hey, thank you so much for having me, Martin. This is fantastic. This is one of my favorite films, so I'm really excited to get into the world of After Hours.
Me too. This is a film where I feel like in the pantheon of Martin Scorsese movies, it's maybe not quite my favorite, but I feel like it should be more people's favorite. You know, it's always kind of like hanging around near the top for me. I like it a lot, mm-hmm. but in some ways, I think when you originally pitched this, you sort of mentioned it as being kind of an oddball in his filmography.
Right.
Which I guess it is, but at the same time, it feels like so specifically Scorsese at the same time.
It is. It's divided in that way. I mean, I think part of that is it is so much a... I mean, his films are so much, especially his vision of New York is so much tied in with the 70s. And I think this is obviously very much a New York film, but it's also very much an 80s film, which is probably the decade least associated with Scorsese. And so I think in that way, it's kind of, there's a lot of acharacteristic elements of it. And it's a different portrait of New York than, say, you know, that we would normally associate with him, like with, say, like Taxi Driver, obviously, or Mean Streets. And this is a very different, more surreal element of New York. Though you can argue that there's a lot of surreal elements that crop up in his other films too, but not to this degree.
Sure. I think you can see certain elements that do pop up in other ones, but it still feels sort of distinctive. I mean, yeah. I think later on, maybe the one that reminds me most of this in his body of work is Bringing Out the Dead, which is kind of the last one to have that sort of, you know, like the last little bit of that flavor of that old New York.
I guess
after that, he sort of mostly gets into the period films for a while, and then he stays away from New York for a while in his filmography. But that kind of feels like the last one. And that's also a little bit surreal, Bringing Out the Dead with Nicolas Cage.
Absolutely.
I thought it was funny. I was looking at what else the screenwriter Joseph Mignon had worked on. And of course, after writing After Hours, he wrote Vampire's Kiss, which has
Nicolas Cage,
to me, like, I kept thinking, like, oh, it'd be cool to, like, program After Hours, Vampire's Kiss, Bringing Out the Dead kind of triple feature.
Wouldn't that be interesting? Yeah. Those are two interesting stories, kind of, you know, kind of, like, they're both, like, both that and Vampire's Kiss are these kind of white collar New York, like yuppie New York, young New Yorkers kind of descent into madness. But, you know, they're very, very different films.
Yeah.
You know, Nicolas Cage's character is far less likable and much more antagonistic in that film. Whereas Griffin Dunne's Paul Hackett is much more the beleaguered everyman, sort of, you know, kind of the trials of Job, you know, hoisted upon him and all in one surreal evening.
I think you're right. Although, it's easy to imagine with the exact same script, somebody being far less likable in Griffin Dunne's role.
Right.
Like if somebody else had played that part, like I could imagine the character being very unlikable because he does some pretty jerk-ass things.
Yeah. I mean, right. I mean, like from the beginning, like when the moment we meet him, when he's talking to Bronson Pinchot's character, who's talking about like his big dreams of like starting a publishing company, and he could give a shit, you know, he's just like, yeah, I'm gonna go. He's so cut off from anyone, from any kind of human connection. But we also understand that that's what he wants. He wants that, but he's in such this sort of dead end job, and he doesn't he doesn't know how to connect with anyone else. And so then when he has this random connection with Roseanne Arquette's character, you know, he immediately latches onto it.
Right. It sort of feels like he rides that line where he keeps it funny because he deserves it a little bit, but he always gets it way worse than really what he deserves.
That's right.
Like, you know, he should be getting it 10%
of what
back,
he
not
is, yeah.
100%, you know, so it feels a little bit like that's where the comedy comes from. Where
absolutely.
I think if it was just a bunch of terrible things happening to an innocent guy, it wouldn't really be that funny. And if he was just like a terrible person having terrible things happening.
Right, then there's no inequality. I mean, that's where the comedy comes from.
Sure. Also, now that you have me thinking about the Vampire's Kiss, both films sort of have this point where everything kind of makes sense, and then they have this very quick turn into something a little bit more strange or surreal. Exactly. Like, I think in After Hours, it's when they're smoking the joint, and he said, "This, I don't even think this is pot." And he sort of has this reaction, which seems to plunge everything into that dark direction that the film takes. And in Vampire's Kiss, I think it's when he gets bit by the bat, which probably gives him rabies and why he goes crazy in that film.
Right, I know, yeah, people have made that made that response. That, yeah, it is just someone...
Yeah.
There's all those different schools of thought with Vampire's Kiss. Like, is it... You know, some actually do believe he has turned into a vampire. Some think it's more like an emasculated male kind of like descent into madness. Yeah. And other people do believe he is just suffering from rabies, you know.
Right. Well, like After Hours, it kind of had me wondering, like, you know, is part of this just him having a bad trip from what he smoked? Like, you know, is there some kind of element to it
could
like
argue that?
That?
Right.
And that heightened, maybe not paranoia. I guess there is some paranoia, but it feels like it's so on edge, the film. And I think that's part of what Martin Scorsese brings to it. And yeah, I mean, some of the other artistic people involved, like Howard Shore's score, it just keeps you on edge. And the editing, where like every so often something just kind of jumps out at you, like the rat in the room, it keeps you from ever feeling at ease, which I think is really...
Absolutely, yeah.
I guess part of the charm of this film is you never really relax. Like it's constantly keeping you on your toes. And
absolutely.
It feels like how I imagine a bad trip would be. I've never had a bad trip, but like that sort of feels like at least part of the experience of the film.
Yeah, I mean, there's already some hints at that, like just like when they meet in the diner and there's the cashier who's practicing ballet spins.
Right.
You know, so there's just those little, there's just these little things that are just, on one hand, those things are like a little weird, but also this is New York. And like you could imagine that something like that happened, you know, seeing that in New York.
Yeah. I was wondering, how were you first introduced to this film? Like, what was your first experience seeing it, if you remember, or what was your first impression of it?
It was one of those that I caught like half of it on cable television. It was one of those that was on syndication and on Comedy Central late at night. And so you would just catch like half of it, and you know, it's like I turn it on when he's like running through the rain, and so it's already I'm catching this sort of surreal landscape. And then I think I caught the whole thing in its entirety and just loved it. But you know, as I was definitely putting the pieces of it together, which is kind of works for a film like this, where you know, you just take one piece of it and then kind of magnify it and be like, okay, what is this? Because every little scene in this film can potentially kind of stand on its own as just this little like surreal portrait. I've always kind of been taken towards, you know, kind of films with a sort of cult aesthetic. Mm-hmm. I grew up loving films like the Coen brothers and that, you know, films by the Coen brothers and, you know, like Luis Buñuel and things like that. So this definitely kind of falls into that, you know, kind of pantheon of just films from a slightly distorted lens.
Absolutely. This seems like the perfect film to discover late at night on television. Oh, like, yeah. I remember, have you seen Jim Jarmusch's Dead Man?
Yes.
With Johnny Depp and Lance Henriksen. And
right.
I remember I watched that film at like 1 a.m. and the next day I was trying to like, wait, did I even really watch that? Was that a real movie or was I dreaming? And then like those kinds of experiences are a great way to be introduced to these sort of cult films or peculiar films.
Absolutely.
And, that sort of disappeared now that you kind of just watch whatever you want to watch.
Whenever.
From beginning to end,
right.
You're
not necessarily at the mercy of some random programmer, you know, the days of like that kind of brilliant programming, like, you know, the days of like Channel Z and stuff are long gone, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, even just watching this film late at night seems right. Like in preparation to record this, I was watching it at 3 p.m. and I felt like a total fraud. I'm like, this isn't the right way to watch it. Just at my leisure during daylight hours.
Right. But it's a film that kind of needs to be like inflicted on you.
Yeah. That's a great way of putting it. This screenplay to me is really interesting also. Mm-hmm. Like it's, I read on the IMDb trivia or someplace like that, that, it was Joseph Minion's graduate thesis screenplay.
That's right.
And Makaveyev was his screenwriting teacher, and he gave it like an A. And I was thinking if it was anyone else, they might have like tossed this script into the shredder or something like that, because it's so unusual. And it kind of goes against a lot of common rules you hear of when people talk about screenwriting, which sort of stood out to me. And I think sometimes I think like the way people approach screenwriting, or at least like criticizing screenwriting, can be a bit backwards, where they have these rules in their head and they apply whether or not a film meets that criteria, and then say like, oh, it doesn't meet these rules, therefore it's bad. And you hear certain things like, oh, coincidence is weak storytelling, or random chance is weak storytelling. And I think the way this film weaponizes coincidence to its advantage and weaponizes just random happenstance is so entertaining and feels so right for this kind of unsettling comedic film, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think there is definitely a sort of surreal use of happenstance in the throughout the film, you know, and the idea that all of these things are happening to him in the course of one, you know, 4 or 5 hours, you know, because it's already, it's already fairly late.
Quite real time, but it feels so compressed that it almost feels like you're following him along in something very close to real time. You know, it's just a couple hours that it takes place.
Yeah, but it's like there's so much that happens, in that course. Yeah, because I think when we, the evening begins fairly late already, like around, like, I think he in theory gets to her place around midnight.
Yeah. And it's like, of course, the girl he meets who kills herself, her boyfriend is the guy he meets across the street. And like, all these things kind of connect. And of course, it's Cheech and Chung who show up later in the film to take him as the statue.
Like, right. Because he slightly resembles the, they think it's the same sculpture that he thwarted them from taking earlier in the film. So it's all of those things kind of add together, and you know, this sort of puzzle, which creates this kind of surreal landscape.
I love some of the misunderstandings too, like the roommate character, you know, all he sees is the Cheech and Chung going off with the statue, and he thinks that they're thieves, and he just sees her tied up. And then, you know, of course he goes in, and it turns out that what the circumstance seems like, it's completely not at all.
Right. You know, he thinks she's tied up, and really she's been bound by her S&M boyfriend.
Horst.
Yes. Horst. Her boyfriend. I mean, you know, it's also funny because, you know, he thinks they're thieves, and they are, just not in that instance.
Just not in that instance. Yeah. One thing that always stands out to me, like, I guess it is kind of a plotty film where you can trace the sequence of events and things are sort of set up and pay off. But for me, it's more like a milieu that the film's about, and sort of a mood or a type of evening that you can kind of relate to. And even though, you know, it's exaggerated for comedy,
sure,
I've never had a night quite like this, but I've always had nights a little bit like this in Toronto or in some bigger cities, you know, where you end up, how am I with this group of people that I don't really know? Or you think the night's going to be one thing and it turns into something completely different, and you're miserable and you just want to get back home. And then the subway station you show up to is down and or not going the right direction, or, you know, these sorts of things. Like, it's all surprisingly relatable, and it just sort of turns it up into that absurd dimension where you can laugh at it.
Yeah, I think we've all kind of had something like that, that just where the evening just kind of gets away from us and we find ourselves completely out of our element. You know, we bargain for one thing and get another thing.
Mm-hmm. You know, even though it's specifically New York, I think like probably anyone who's lived in or been in a big city can probably relate to that to some degree. Like the
absolutely,
you know, even these like strange intimate moments with absolute strangers,
right?
Or, you know, you make friends, you make enemies, you make, like, and sometimes it's the same people, you
know? Yeah, that turns into one turns into the other, you know, based on circumstance. You know, I mean, living in LA, I have a similar experience where you'll meet people over the course of an evening, and you know, you'll meet people at a party or something and get into a conversation, and they're your friends for that evening, but then, you know, you could run into them a week later and they'll walk right by you, you know.
Sure.
You know, because that's, you know, there's that kind of indifference, you know.
Absolutely. Or like situations where you end up in over your head, and like, I don't drink, so I don't go out to clubs or bars really. But like, do you know Superbad?
Sure.
I always think of the scene with Michael Cera where he's like in this room with the guys partying and they think it's somebody's cousin and they're asking him to sing. I always feel like that's once in a while when I end up in some situation where it's like, oh, I really shouldn't be here. It's just you know, too much for me. And I think like that's part of the comedy in After Hours too, is just seeing this yuppie in like the the nightclub where everyone has a mohawk and they're trying to shave his head and stuff like that, where he just seems out of his element for a lot of it.
Yeah, that punk club is great. And you know that that exchange he has with the bouncer outside is the first part of it is taken almost verbatim from the Kafka piece Before the Law.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it fits perfectly because this is sort of a Kafka scenario where he's just trying to get home and keeps kind of finding himself in this loop where he can't get out. And
right, that circuitous kind of plot. Right. You know, which of course is exactly what the film fulfills at the end, where he ends up right back where he started.
Sure. And in that way, like, I think one thing in Kafka's writing that I think is always a little bit underrated is the sense of humor.
Yeah.
You know, you see certain adaptations of Kafka and it's got to be black and white and dreary and serious. But
right.
Like, Kafka can be very, very funny. And in some ways, like, I think there was some kind of interview with Stanley Kubrick on The Shining where he was talking about how Kafka stuff, it's always done in this sort of stylized black and white way. It, like, really, you know, to do it properly, you should try to make it, like, as mundane as possible.
Right.
Or maybe mundane's not quite right. But, like, I think After Hours probably feels closer to the spirit of some of Kafka's stories than some actual Kafka adaptations. You know, I always think, like, Metamorphosis, it's a story about a guy who eats shit and dies. Like, it's funny, you know. And
yeah,
I think sometimes that element, it's not picked up on, and, you know, just the inclusion of that with the bouncer to me sort of says, like, oh, okay, there's a sort of literary awareness here.
Absolutely.
There's a couple other literary references I know you wanted to mention.
Right. Yeah. Right. Throughout. Yeah. Exactly. But back to what you were saying about Kafka, I mean, going against kind of the cliched interpretation of his work, I think this definitely feels more in keeping, as you say, and also just because of some interpretations are very bleak and dreary and, you know, black and white. You know, this is, of course, it's very vibrant, very colorful. Mm-hmm. The colors and the vibrancy become kind of more, you know, treacherous and creates that sort of violent, surreal world he has to navigate through. But it's not that kind of that bleak black and white, you know, expressionist shadows. It's these very, it's like the treacherous glow of the neon lights and all of the fluorescence in the punk club and everything. And I also love in the punk club that you see that as he's leaving the club, there's the pan up to Scorsese manning the spotlight. So it's almost this kind of nods. It's his little Hitchcock cameo, and is this kind of nod saying, like, you know, I'm here. I'm in control of this. You know, it's a lovely little moment.
Right. Yeah, I always appreciate the little Scorsese cameos. Yeah. There's a couple of good ones. This one's probably up there as far as cameos, putting himself in the nightclub way up top with the light
in the god position. You know, it's very fun. This is probably one of his few, like, out and out comedies, you know. And before this, he had done King of Comedy, which was more dark, kind of a dark satirical drama.
I mean, one thing that really stood out to me is how different the sense of humor is between King of Comedy and After Hours, even though they're both basically dark comedies.
Yes.
Like, the sense of humor for me in King of Comedy, it's all cringe humor.
Very.
Like, I think even before cringe humor was really a thing, it's just like, oh, like every
moment
is this human train wreck, you know.
Right.
And After Hours, it's more this comedy of the absurd, or this sort of, like, it's kind of a cliche to say, like, oh, this reminds me of David Lynch anytime something weird comes up in a film.
That.
But they mentioned specifically, I had a friend who said, like, the the sense of humor is a little bit like something you'd see in David Lynch, where it's, like, so kind of deadpan, but something just feels a little bit off.
Yes.
That's what makes it funny.
Yes.
You know, some of these exchanges sound like they could come out of, you know, one of the funnier parts of episode of Twin Peaks or something. Like,
yes.
One of the things in the movie that gets the biggest laugh out of me is when he has that snapping moment after he smoked the joint, and he's talking about, he's asking where the bagel paperweights are.
Right. Cough it up. Yeah.
Where are those Plaster of Paris paperweights anyway? I mean, that's what I came down here for in the first place. Well, that's not entirely true. I came to see you. But where are the paperweights? That's what I want to see now.
What's the matter?
I said I want to see a Plaster of Paris bagel and cream cheese paperweight. Now cough it up.
Right now?
Yes, right now.
They're in Kiki's bedroom.
Then get them. because as we sit here chatting, there are important papers flying rampant around my apartment because I don't have anything to hold them down with.
It's so funny to me because, like, it's such a ridiculous thing to say where, like, it's this urgent matter that it gets this bagel paperweight, which of course,
right,
and bagel paperweight has to show up again in the movie.
I mean, it's justifiable that he's trying to, he's having this kind of bizarre reaction because he just wants to get out of this situation and he doesn't know how. So the only thing he can think to go to is the bagel and cream cheese paperweights, and so it creates this kind of absurd, you know, exchange. And which I think is all, just a lot of the movie where, you know, again, he's really just trying to get out of this bizarre situation. But, you know, but then kind of the more he interacts with this in this strange world, the stranger it gets.
Absolutely. And I love just the cast of characters. Like, it's such a great cast in this film of people to run into where, you know, all these character actors and people where it's just like it gives you that feeling of running into new, maybe strange people at night. I really love that. Like, Rosanna Arquette, of course, is probably the first one you'd think of in this film. Cheech and Chong, like, it's still strange to me that, oh yeah, there's a Martin Scorsese film that has Cheech and Chong in it, but it's so perfect. And like, even Dick Miller.
Oh, Dick Miller, yeah.
And he sort of sets it up like, you know, have fun tonight, like, oh, this one's on me. Which it sort of like feels almost wrong when they come back and it's somebody else at the diner instead of Dick Miller. Like, it's like, oh, like you crossed into a parallel universe almost.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's always, I always love it when Dick Miller shows up in anything. But I was noticing, like, this time his kind of relationship with Marcy, Rosanna Arquette's character, and how he regards her. Mm-hmm. You kind of get the sense that, you know, maybe he's like kind of a, you know, an adoptive uncle kind of role in her life or something, you know, where he's like, oh, you know, this one's on me, you know, because it's known that she has suffered this, you know, terrible trauma and all these other things. So there's certain people in her life who are kind of looking out after her. And, you know, it kind of seems like he might be one of them.
Yeah. And he gets all that across with like very little,
in just 30 seconds.
And,
yeah.
You know, just, yeah, it's perfect. I mean, I don't, the Marcy storyline is so sad, actually. Yeah. Like, when you sort of step back and look at it, like, there's quite a lot of darkness in this film. Yeah. And there's also that element of, it's put into Paul's head that maybe she has these burn scars. And like, that's part of, I think, why he's anxious around her and that tension. And like, why after he finds her dead, he has to lift the blanket and look if she had scars or not. You know, it was like, him checking the cream and him wondering why she was at the pharmacy. And it just sort of builds and builds. And you kind of get the, maybe that's the reason why he rejects her at that moment, that crucial moment.
Yeah, that's so interesting. He's so upset by that. I mean, that's really kind of what pushes him over the edge. But then after the end, he has to see if that was true or not.
And there is sort of this reoccurring pattern with the Paul character running into women who at first are kind of kind and generous to him, and then who he eventually like either does something or like something that's through his fault kind of turns them on him, or it comes back to bite him in some way. Like, I really like Catherine O'Hara showing up later in this movie. National Canadian treasure, Catherine O'Hara. but, you know, I just like the moment where she sees the wanted poster, which comes out of the previous sort of encounter that he's had with a woman that's gone bad.
Yes.
Where she sets him up as a thief. And just the way that, I think the character's name is Gail, Catherine O'Hara's character.
Yeah.
Turns on Paul and, you know, you're in a lot of trouble, buddy.
Like, right. You're dead, pal. Yeah.
Him not really understanding what's happening or why, but, you know, just goes from maybe he's going to have a ride home to, oh no, things have gone bad again.
Right. Yeah. And then finds himself being pursued by this Mr. Softy truck, which is just a wonderful image.
And I forget if that's right before or right after. You get, to me, what kind of encapsulates the whole film in a nutshell is, I think he's on like a fire escape and he just sees through a window a murder happen.
Yes.
And says like, oh, I'm gonna get blamed for this. And to me, that's like the whole film kind of
that's such a beautiful moment.
Dark and funny and unexpected, and it's just like everything that the movie is within that one single moment.
There's so many things like that. Another great visual for me, he's at the urinal and he sees that little doodle on the wall of the shark on a man's penis.
Oh, I love that.
It's so great. Yeah. that again, that also just kind of sums things up so much, you know.
Yeah, that's a perfect bit of I guess it's not foreshadowing because that doesn't actually happen, but it just sort of sets the tone a little bit. Like, things are going to get worse. Like, somehow it all makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, there's just all these little clues just everywhere, just kind of hinting his doom or the futility of his existence.
Right.
You know, he's kind of stepping out of his element and then kind of being punished for it.
I was thinking, too, like... You know, when they talk about, oh, there's only so many types of stories, like how much this is an odyssey through the night. And mm-hmm. other films have kind of done something similar. Like, I guess you could say Eyes Wide Shut kind of has that, like, odyssey through the night sort of feel to it for that middle section anyway.
But, right.
Like, as an odyssey story, I was thinking how funny it is that he's so close to home, really, but he just can't get back, and how that gets drawn out. And,
yes.
You know, that's part of the absurdity. And, like, the real... Odyssey story, I remember I was reading that how close Ithaca and historic Troy were. Like, I think, like, it's like a 10-day boat trip with Bronze Age boats. So, like, the idea that it took, like, Odysseus 10 years to get back, like, oh, wait, this is funny. Like, wait, this is a comedy. So, I don't know. That just sort of dawned on me that, you know, there's something very funny about this idea that, like, he's so close to home, but he's so out of his element, and it's just far enough away that he can't get back. And, like, he never does get home in the film. Like,
right.
I think they mentioned that for a while they kind of struggled to figure out what the ending should be for After Hours.
I know, and yeah.
Do you want to say whose idea it was to end the film the way it is?
It was Michael Powell, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Who is married to Thelma Schoonmaker.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's how it came about. Have you read about one of the ideas that they actually toyed with was?
Oh, I saw there were a couple. I think one of them was that it gets permanently trapped at the statue. And...
Yes, that was the original one. Like, I think they actually shot that where it was just the camera just pulls back as the van goes away, and that was the ending. But they play with other endings.
So the way it ends, like, to me, that's kind of the perfect ending for it. Where, like, it's perfect. He never gets home. And it's just sort of, like you said, getting back to these existential themes, this sort of loop where he ends up back to where he starts. Exactly.
I know one ending that they actually, I think they actually storyboarded this idea was when he goes down into the basement with that woman, June, at the bar. And, you know, he's trying to hide from the mob that he, they wrote out a sequence where he hides in her vagina and is then into her womb. He crawls into her vagina, hides in her womb, and is then birthed out onto the freeway.
Which might have been too bizarre even for this film.
Even for this.
Well, like, yeah. I know somebody mentioned, like, at first it was going to be a Tim Burton film.
Yes.
And this is, like, way, way early Tim Burton.
This would have been his first film.
Yeah. I guess Scorsese, he was trying to put together Last Temptation of Christ, and that wasn't going well, and he just kind of needed a film to make.
Right. They had come to him before. Yeah. He was working on Temptation of Christ, and then when that got delayed, he came back around, was interested in this again, and they were talking to Tim Burton about it, who was, I think, pretty much ready to sign on, and then we're kind of saying in passing, like, oh, you know, it's kind of funny. You know, we just got a call from Martin Scorsese, who's now interested in this. And, like, as soon as Tim Burton heard that, he was like, I'm walking. Like, you know, he needs to direct this movie, which I think is great, you know, for someone like that to have that kind of foresight.
And, like, I love 80s, 90s Tim Burton, but I feel like it would have had to have become a different film to be a Tim Burton film, you know,
and
maybe a film like Tim Burton's version, maybe it would have made sense for him to hide inside
a vagina. Exactly.
The climax,
right. I think it would have pushed it. I think it would have been more, it would have been less like a New York movie and more just this kind of surreal caper film.
Yeah. I would have had to have imagined it turning into, like, you know, Dr. Caligari buildings and stuff like that.
Maybe a little more of that traditional, like, expressionistic Kafka imagining, you know.
Yeah. Or what was that, the Woody Allen film, the black and white one, from, like, early 90s?
Shadows and Fog.
Shadows and Fog, right. Like, I'm just like, I think, you know, there's probably a version of After Hours where it could have turned out something like that instead. Mm-hmm. But I'm really happy with the way it turned out. After Hours, like, to me, it just feels like, oh, this is right, this is the right way to tell this story, and the right way for it to end up. And even if it's hard to sort of pinpoint exactly what it all adds up to. It just, you know, like, oh, of course he has to end up back at work right in time for the next day. And yeah, it all kind of fits together in a way that just makes sense on some intuitive level. Like,
right. I mean,
getting back to like the sort of nights, like after hours, like there's definitely been times where it's like you give up trying to get home and you're just like, I'm going to crash on my friend's floor until I've got like work in the morning.
Exactly.
Like, you know, that kind of feeling where it's like at a certain point, you just want to make it in time to get to work the next day instead of going back and doing your thing.
Right. Well, yeah, there's that great line at the, when he's with the woman at the bar at the end, and, you know, and she's asking him why is he nice to her? Why is he doing this? And he says, I just want to live.
Yep.
And I think, and it, when it comes down to it's, you know, and I suppose you could kind of extrapolate thematically from that statement, you know, and like, what does it mean? Sure. And, you know, when we meet him in the beginning, is he really living? Is he truly, you know, what is the life that he's accepted for himself? And, you know, kind of, you know, taking it from there that he is this kind of, he's not really present in his own life. And so he is kind of having to fight for his life in a way that he never has before.
And I think even the music they play at that scene just after he says, I want to live, and they're dancing, and it's...
Is this all there is?
Is that all there is?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it, you know, it's sort of questioning... It feels like it could be him questioning his life and
right.
if there's more to it or if there should be more to it.
And right. And it's kind of almost an answer to that after that he is just, you know, deposited back at work again.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Yeah, that's fun.
Whenever it's a comedy on the podcast, I feel like the first instinct is to end up quoting the funniest lines from the movie.
Or, sure.
But I was wondering if you do have any favorite lines or funniest scenes or favorite scenes.
Oh, I mean, there's so many. I think, you know, a film like this is, yeah, you know, insanely quotable. I mean, I think, one of my favorite little moments is when he's at the bar with John Hurd and he can't get the, he can't open the cash register. And, he's like, oh no, it's fine. And, you know, and John Hurd says, oh, well, what if I got a rush? I mean, it's just this like this absurd little moment of like, wait, the bar is completely yeah. dead. And he just goes, well, what if I got a rush right now? I mean, it's just that kind yeah. of, there's just those little moments like that where it's just, there's a real kind of absurd humor to it, you know, because of course the place is completely dead and there's, you know, more serious matters at hand, but, you know, that's just, you know, that's kind of immediately where his brain goes. I think that's great. The lines that I hold on to are kind of the ones that you would kind of dismiss at first glance, but like another one I love is he's with her roommate and he gets like the paper mache on his shirt and she puts it in the wash and she says, she has the line of like, oh, don't you want to look nice for your big date?
Yeah,
you know, and it's just that kind of it's one of those lines that just kind of sets the scene. I was also noticing kind of the interesting sort of sexual tension between him and the roommate, where there's part of him where he does have this connection to Rosanna Arquette's character, but he also does kind of, but it's also clear this time, he also just kind of wants to get laid. He would be fine if he just, yeah. he just finds someone well, to fuck for the
like,
night, you know,
because roommate, you can tell like he has a hard time gauging, like, is she actually coming on to me? Or is like, when you meet somebody new and it's hard yeah. to tell, like, are they just always like this or are they being flirtatious or, there's a part from that scene that I kind of stole for one of my short films.
Oh, yeah?
A couple of years ago where I always thought it was really funny, the gag where like he's giving her the massage and it feels like it's building up to this kind of intimate moment and then she's just asleep, which I ripped that off for one of my short films, which is also this sort of like nighttime odyssey kind of a story where, you know, this woman's actually into him and he's talking about his problems and she just conks out sleeping.
It's great. But, yeah.
I mean, this film also had its kind of run-ins with accusations of stealing.
Right. I think it's interesting. Yeah. It's interesting for me because it involves one of my favorite writers and personalities, Joe Frank, who is a KCRW radio personality for many years and would, you know, write these kind of similarly bizarre sort of fever dream monologues and stories that kind of would kind of careen from very personal memoir into these sort of bizarre, surreal landscapes. And so he took one of, so it was revealed later that one of his early monologues called Lies was, you know, there was key elements of that story that, that show up in this of like meeting a girl randomly, you know, at a coffee shop, having this bizarre conversation, her talking about a marriage gone wrong, having, you know, and then down to like the roommate who makes the bagel and cream cheese paperweights. You know,
right.
Yeah. I mean, like that, I mean, that detail is so unmistakable. Also, the original name of the screenplay was Lies. Just like the monologue, that was the working title before it was called After Hours, was Lies. So, yeah, I mean, he was clearly kind of influenced by that and kind of used that as a jumping off point. I think they were sued and they reached a settlement, you know, for an undisclosed amount later. But on one hand, I certainly never condone plagiarism, but on the other, I mean, the fact that it, that he was kind of able to. To use that as a jumping off point. I mean, I think it probably, you know, in hindsight, he probably should have gone back and altered some of those elements just a little bit.
Or you never know, like if he had contacted Joe Frank, maybe he could have gotten it for nothing. Like,
right. I think it was pretty much the principle of it.
Like, have you ever heard Harlan Ellison talk about suing James Cameron over the Terminator?
No.
Well, cause I guess what happened, James Cameron, I think, like, in an early magazine article, some science fiction magazine, basically fessed up. He's like, oh, yeah, I got the idea from these, like, old Outer Limits episodes. And two of them were written by Harlan Ellison, who was, like, still alive at the time.
Sure.
I mean, he only died kind of recently.
Yeah, exactly.
But he, I guess it got back to him, and he saw the film, and he sued. And basically, I think what he said is, like, Harlan Ellison was sort of notoriously litigious, but he was basically like, yeah, if, like, he had just asked me, I would have given it to him. Like,
right.
And he was very complimentary about the film too. He's like, oh yeah, I love the Terminator, but I know where it got its ideas from.
Right.
So
yeah, you know, it was just a matter of principle.
I don't think it's I can see why Joe Frank would sue to get at least a cut of the money from the film. So.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you listen to some of his stuff, there is especially kind of his middle period stuff where his work got a lot more surreal. I mean, I think you can definitely kind of see how Joseph Minion was kind of influenced by his work. He had a whole story he wrote where he was trying to write and a neighbor's dog kept barking. And he goes down this rabbit hole of like trying to figure out, you know, if he should poison the dog and all of these different scenarios and just, you know, and is just, and tries to, you know, reason with the neighbors, tries to reason with the dog and, you know, and it just, his frustration and madness just keeps escalating and escalating. And it doesn't really reach a conclusion. It just kind of taps out at a certain point. You're kind of left with this sort of madness. And that's kind of very akin to what the kind of thing you're left with in After Hours, where there's not really a resolution, you know. There's still this angry mob that's out there looking for him. There's still, you know, he really never got what he wanted. He just lives to meet another day.
Yeah. Again, like I think it's not so much about the plot as that mood or that milieu like you're describing. And I don't, Griffin Dunn, I know he's done quite a bit, but like I mostly just think of him in this and playing the zombie ghost in American Werewolf.
Right.
So like I think he's kind of an underrated comedic talent. Like I think he's really funny in this. And there's something like a little bit, maybe it's the eyebrows, but like Scorsese surrogate about his character too, where like he kind of matches some of that Scorsese manic energy. Like, you know, not every Scorsese protagonist seems as much like Martin Scorsese as Griffin Dunn does in this.
Which is interesting. Yeah. I mean, it's, I think some of like the early Keitel was a little bit, you know, he was serving that a little bit, and then he kind of gets away from it a little bit, you know, like with Taxi Driver. I think he's taking that a little more extreme, but then with Griffin Dunn, just the way he dresses him, the way he kind of, I think I have heard he was kind of, you know, directed to kind of model certain things after him. But yeah, you do definitely see some of those comparisons.
Yeah. And I think like the fact that Scorsese made the film very quickly and kind of in between a larger project, mm-hmm. like sometimes those turn out in certain filmmakers' bodies of work. Like it happens where you're sort of working on a bigger project and then like you have an opportunity to go off and do this little thing and ends up actually being very personal and better almost than it has any right to be. Like I always think of Wong Kar-wai working on Ashes of Time, and mm-hmm. it was just like slogging on and on and on, and he went and like whipped off Chungking Express, and I think Chungking Express is a million times better than Ashes of Time, but
right.
No, like I still love I really love Last Temptation of Christ. Like that's one of my favorite Scorsese films too, but I think, you know, the fact that pre-production was dragging on and the multiple times trying to make it, it's almost like he needed a little refresh or just like to make a film just to kind of get back into the groove, I guess. And
you,
I think
you see that a lot about,
like, being
yeah.
inspired a little bit by I think he said he was like inspired by Rainer Werner Fassbinder in just how to shoot quickly yeah. and just kind of how to bang out a movie really fast. And it has that kind of energy to it, which I don't think is a bad thing at all for After Hours. Like, I think it just feels like a product of some spontaneity and energy, and it's got a life to it that I think makes it stand out.
Yeah. Like when Steven Soderbergh, you know, went off and made Schizopolis for like almost no money.
That's a perfect example.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, starred in the film and made it for, you know, like just a couple hundred grand and, you know, at a fraction of the budget he had been making, you know, any of his other films. And and then just does something that's, again, where he's just breaking all of the rules. It doesn't have, you know, the same kind of production constraints. It has a very original kind of manic energy.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect kind of situation to compare it to.
Yeah.
That would also be a good double feature, After Hours and Schizopolis.
Oh, yeah. There's that kind of absurdist, kind of anarchic sensibility in both of those.
Yeah. Have you ever heard the audio commentary for Schizopolis?
No, I haven't.
Oh, my God. It's so much fun where it's... Or it's like Soderbergh interviewing himself almost, or doing a commentary as if he's like two people almost.
Oh, that's great.
And, you know, oh, like I really loved working with the director and all that. How great, you know, like it's just hilarious if you ever get a chance to
That's really to that. Funny. That's really funny. Yeah. That's perfect. That'd be, and I mean, it's a perfect film to kind of do something like that for. Another one I think that could make an interesting double feature. They're very unique in their own way is, Jonathan Demme's Something Wild.
Oh, that would be a great one too. And just sort of that idea of like, I'm going to follow this woman, and it leads this kind of straight-laced character into this whole other world where he's...
Yes, and this kind of surreal landscape.
Yeah.
There's certain kind of visual flourishes in that movie where there's almost these like visual cues, like, you know, where the film takes a completely different turn.
Yeah.
And there's little surrealist touches.
Even like
in
the
that
cameos,
too.
Like the type of character actors that show up in it are like having a John Waters cameo
yeah.
feels like something
so perfect.
Comparable to like having Cheech and Chong show up or, you know,
exactly.
that kind of a feeling.
Yeah.
Like,
and
Ray Liotta's character could walk into After Hours and he would fit right in.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Exactly. You could see that. Yeah. Or conversely, you could easily see Dick Miller showing up in Something Wild.
Exactly.
You know.
And I know you mentioned a little while ago that, or you mentioned in emails that, like, in some ways it parallels Wizard of Oz or Alice in Wonderland,
sure.
these types of stories.
I do feel like it's purposeful, like, when they make the Wizard of Oz reference, like, about her husband saying surrender Dorothy when he orgasms. You know? But, yeah, there is that, but there is definitely that idea of being, you know, this is kind of, I mean, I call this, like, kind of a down the rabbit hole kind of movie, where it's just,
yeah.
you know, a normal character is plunged into a surreal world, or is kind of whisked off into a land of Oz.
No place like home. There's no place like home. No
Wake up, honey.
There's no place like home.
The It's All a Dream kind of interpretations are in some ways a little bit meaningless, because every movie's kind of a dream when you put it that way. But like, to me, like I think there was sort of this feeling of like, is all of this real, or is the way he's experiencing everything, the way it's actually happening, like after he kind of smokes that joint, it just feels like there's this one moment where things kind of turn and you're not sure how much of it's real anymore. Like, right. It takes on that surreal quality. Like, it reminded me a little bit of the Sid and Nancy film biopic, where like there's sort of this turning point where it's like, oh wait, like after everything is this real? Like,
right.
You know, that sort of feeling stuck out to me. And I thought like maybe.
That's interesting.
You know, if you wanted to have some other take on it, aside from taking the movie at face value, that would be my entry point.
Yeah, I know that does seem to be like kind of like a go-to, like one of the go-to theories is, yeah, like, you know, is this a dream or is it not? I know
it's pretty meaningless. Like, it's
exactly, yeah. It's like, what's the point then? I mean, if that's it, yeah, I mean, that's just such an easy default. It reminds me, it's kind of funny, there's a popular film podcast, How Did This Get Made, has a running gag in a lot of their episodes where they try to posit if a film is basically a Jacob's Ladder scenario. Sure. And at what right. So at what point does the character die and the rest of the film become a fever dream before as they expire? So yeah, and it's just kind of this like running gag, I mean, you know, throughout the film. Yeah. Because of course it's a ridiculous thing.
Yeah, although like Scorsese has kind of experimented with unreliable narrators. Sure. And that sort of thing, like there's that bit in Wolf of Wall Street where he's saying like, oh no, the car was actually this color, or right. There are little things in I think Raging Bull or Goodfellas where you're sort of meant to question like, okay, there's some discrepancy between how the main character is taking things versus what the reality is. And
yeah,
I think you know, even if it's not all a dream or if it's not all real, I think it does sort of tip you off that you're meant to have a little bit of a, I guess, an ironic distance from Griffin Dunne's character, to me anyway, where like it's okay to kind of laugh at him and understand that like things are going to get outrageous and only increasingly outrageous from this point onwards.
Yeah, I mean, even a film like Taxi Driver, where you know the protagonist is you have, you're dealing with kind of an anti-hero who sees himself throughout the film as a heroic character, but then, you know, there are moments where the narration steps back and reveals that he's actually, you know, absolutely, a terror, yeah, to other people.
Yeah, that's actually probably the best example of that, now that you mention it. That's another film that could have a Jacob's Ladder moment, where after the big shootout, the like camera pulls up like his soul going off to heaven or whatever.
Exactly.
And like the last epilogue could be all in his dying mind or something.
Right, really of having I've heard his that one, too. Having his one last encounter with Cybill Shepherd and all of that, yeah. That's
although
all
I'd much prefer the idea that Travis Bickle is just like a horrible human being who unintentionally became a hero by just like shooting the right people in a certain circumstance. Like, yeah. To me, that kind of feels a little bit more biting. But you can't take everything the main character's experiencing at face value. But I don't know.
That's right. Yeah, and and you get that, and you also get that like in King of Comedy too, with his sort of the imagined scenarios he has and that sort of thing. He also, you know, sees himself very differently as how he's perceived.
Yeah. There it's more prominent, to the point where like you can even also wonder if the last scene is meant to be real or not.
Right.
And
you
know, there's some scenes that are explicitly not when he's talking to Jerry Lewis.
But, exactly.
That there it's more overt, where like it does kind of let you know just through the editing like what's real or not. And
exactly,
it just makes it more uncomfortable when he runs into the real Jerry Lewis in that movie. Or I guess right. He's not actually playing himself, but close enough.
A facsimile. Yeah.
I don't know. That was just something I was thinking about this time around. Was
fare is a dollar and a half.
What?
Fare went up to a dollar and a half as of midnight.
You're kidding. I've got 97 cents.
No.
It's raining like mad out there.
No.
Would you just give me a break? I really just want to go home.
I'm sorry. I can't do that. I could lose my job.
Well, who would know exactly?
I could go to a party, get drunk, talk to someone. Who knows?
Well, Galen, thank you for coming on and pitching the film. If folks want to find you online, or if there's anything you'd like to plug, what can they check out?
I'm an actor, and you can find me on Instagram @Galen Howard. I post a lot of post a lot of my work there. And I have a couple things that are in post right now that I've done. I did I acted in a really wonderful dramatic comedy called Moon Manor that's in production right now. It's probably going to be hitting festivals probably early next year with Lou Taylor Pucci and Richard Reilly. And yeah, you can follow me on Instagram. I'm at you can find me on Twitter @_Galen_Howard_ because I just love underscores, apparently.
They're wonderful.
Yes.
Well, thank you again. And if folks want to follow this show, of course, it's flixwise.com, @flixwise on Twitter, @MovieKessler on Twitter. And I guess until next time, take care, listeners. Be careful out there in the dark, dark night.
Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friends, then dancing, let's break out the booze and have a ball. If that's all.